Welcome back to BDSM Reimagined. Listeners, I am so excited to have Phil on our show today. Phil is the owner of the Master Slave Lifestyle website and podcast. You can find his website on masterslavelifestyle.com. The link is below. Now, Phil is quite an exceptional character. The amount of work and effort that this man has put into the BDSM community is just bewildering. Go to his site, have a look, and you'll see what I mean. He's got articles, he's got groups, he's got coaching. So it's very important to mention that he's also a BDSM lifestyle coach, and he has helped many people work through their dominant, submissive lifestyles, helping them create deeper links, deeper connections. It's so impressive. He's reached a wide audience on his podcast series, which covers an incredible range of topics. It's very holistic. And if you actually go to his podcast series now, we're recording in the month of August 2023, then he's going through the book that we're going to be talking about today. So he's looking at the archetypes that we're going to be looking at. I know I'm using a lot of hyperboles and adjectives. It's all purpose. This guy is incredible, and I feel very lucky and honored to be able to even talk to him about this. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Thank you so much. It's really humbling to hear that. Thank you.
How is it in Berlin? We're calling you from Berlin, aren't we?
Yes. So in Berlin, we're in the middle of a very humid heat wave at the moment. So it's hot out here.
Yeah.
Not much opportunity for leather unless you're mad.
Yeah. So just before we get onto the show, I just want to know more about you. How did you come to create your website, your podcast? What came first? What was the inspiration?
So I've always identified as a slave, even from when I was young. And when I was about 17 or 18, on the second day I had the internet, I discovered that I wasn't mad. And actually, there was a number of people that shared this. And that kind of really set out, let's say, a journey of wanting to be a slave. And for me, I always wanted to be a 24/7 living slave. The idea of, you know, just having sessions never even really occurred to me. That was how much it was ingrained in me. And over the masters I saw, unfortunately, I saw some pretty horrific ones and ended up pretty damaged and hurt. And that ended up, you know, at one point having my, let's say, my slavery self completely locked away, and I had to figure out how to heal it. In some ways, not even a therapist knew how to do that. And that led me to really explore what is slavery, what is mastery, what is submission. And so I started to learn and discover a lot of these things. And then a number of years later, when I'd moved to Berlin for a master, and then me and that master broken up, I'd been part of a workshop and a seed had been planted that perhaps part of my purpose was to help people to go on their journeys and not have as hard a journey as I had, to impart some of my knowledge and to help. And that is where Master Slave Lifestyle was born. And I think I kind of created a very basic website with 5 articles of just like, let's see if anyone's interested in it. And slowly I suddenly realized there's a great interest. And then I put a lot more effort in. And then over COVID, I decided to start with the podcast as well. And then I had the mad idea a little while ago to try and write a book.
And that's the book that we're going to be talking about today, Light and Shadow, The Psychology of Master-Slave Relationships. And that book can be found on your website.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you go to masterslavelifestyle.com/book and you'll see it there.
Yeah, definitely. Before we jump into that book, I'm just curious, what do you think it is about you that is so interested in sharing your journey?
So for me, it's sort of almost like a message from the universe. You know, it feels like it's part of my purpose. And the more that I do that, the better I feel that I align. What's very strange is right now I'm sort of going through a transition where I'm actually exploring being more a master than a slave. And, you know, at the moment it's a transition. I don't know what's going to happen. You know, but it might be if I do collar a slave, you know, that my service and my slave aspect will be very much directed towards the community going forward, you know. And then from a relationship point of view, it's more about me using my power to shape and transform a slave and have them serve me. So it's really is almost like part of the reason why I'm on this planet is to help other people.
Yeah, that comes through your website and this book as well. It's a big thing, I'd say, for you to explore the dominant role, given how much of a slave energy comes through.
Yeah, it's been a few years in the making, but COVID sort of put a pause to it the first time, and then I thought I'd found two very good masters who ended up ghosting me, and I kind of started this year, kind of sat down and was going, really, what do I want to do? And it was like, actually, I think I really want to explore this part of myself. You know, and what's interesting is because of the amount of experience I have, it's not, can I be a master? It's like, do I enjoy being a master is the main question. And so far, the answer is yes. It's been incredibly fulfilling.
I think there's a whole episode just on that, just talk about that transition. But we're here to focus on this book, which really, really got my attention because archetypes is something which I've always been interested in before I even got into kink and BDSM. I've always been interested in these ideas of archetypes and trying to make connections in BDSM Reimagined in season two, myself and my co-host Indy, which isn't here today. We try to think through archetypes a little bit, trying to make connections because we felt that there was a bigger energy sitting behind the dominant and submissive personas that we put out there. And we couldn't really find the words or a framework to think about it. For me, archetypes was the closest, but I couldn't make the connections. I couldn't think it through. And then bam, here comes your book. And I am just thinking, wow, finally, someone is having a conversation in a very simple yet practical and thorough way about archetypes and how it's linked to the BDSM and kink community and energies. So can you give just a bit of insight into how you came into this book, and then we can actually talk about what archetypes are, etc. So how did this book come to be?
So I had this idea, I think it was during 2020, that I wanted to start a podcast, but also I wanted this idea of, could people test themselves in some sort of quiz to find out more about their mastery or slavery? I had no idea what I was getting myself into with that, to be honest, because you know, master-slave relationships are very different, and the sort of masters and the sort of slaves are very different as well. So how could I come up with a sort of framework without judging? You know, both as a master or slave, I really like the more intense total power exchange, dehumanization, objectification, whereas there are other people that might judge that and go, there's no way I would do that. That is just not healthy. Whereas there's other people like me that love it. But yet, there is also very clearly bad masters and bad slaves. You know, in fact, you know, I've had an experience with one master, and I'm not exaggerating when I say it. I really felt like I touched the face of evil with him. And so there is this idea of, okay, we can't really judge different relationships based on personal likes or dislikes, but there is also things that are good and things that are clearly bad, and things that are absolutely amazing and things that are horrific. And so I was trying to basically figure out how to solve that riddle. Yeah. And that research was then the start of what then turned into this book.
Yeah. So you kind of found a way of exploring this and navigating these different experiences and temperaments and personalities through archetypes.
Yeah, the reason why I liked these archetypes in particular is it focuses more on intent and mindset. So not really what you're doing. Are you dehumanizing a slave, or are you going out to John Lewis and sorting out what curtains to buy as partners? You know, instead, it's more about the mindset around the intent that people are bringing. And that way I was able to kind of step out of the judging part, but then clearly say that these mindsets or intents are good. But if you start to, let's say, move to a dark side, or you already have a dark side, then your intent and mindset might not be the healthiest.
I understand. For those listeners who aren't familiar with the word archetype, what can you say about that? What are archetypes?
So archetypes, you can think of them a bit like common patterns. So, you know, some people might have done it through a test they've done in teams in the office, known as Myers-Briggs or Clinton Strengths. These are archetypes. Or there's far more flippant examples, such as if you go to BuzzFeed and find out what character from Friends you are. These are all forms of archetypes. Some are much deeper and some are much more shallow. And with these archetypes that I used in particular, they're based on Jungian psychology, and they're based on what was originally called the male archetypes, but also they are actually there for any sexuality or gender. And these kind of go really deep into, let's say, our primitive nature, things that are almost there in our psychology that our, most primitive ancestors have. And it's sort of baked into our psyche and baked into our culture. And so across in the world, we tend to have these because it's just based on how we're wired. And the four archetypes are king, warrior, magician, and lover. Or from a gender neutral point of view, sovereign, action taker, magician, lover. And as I say those words, everyone who's listening probably gets an idea of what I mean. When I use the word king, you probably have a vision and a set of behaviors or attributes that you put onto that. And the reason why you can do that so easily is that these are so ingrained into our society and into our cultures that we just know what they are.
Yeah, very well said. I was thinking some of those sort of superficial archetypes. Would it be accurate to say, for the gay community, bear, cub, jock, twink, are these sort of superficial archetypes, or is this in a different direction?
I would think of this more like a tribe or, a label for your identity. So I could label myself as a slave or a master or as a muscle bear. They're sort of labels that I'm giving myself that mean something to me, but they're probably not as deep as the archetypes, because regardless of me, being slave, master, or bear, or otter, or something else, they those archetypes that I've just mentioned still exist.
Yeah. So we have these four primary archetypes. Are there anything else that we need to know about them, or do they just remain as those four?
So for this framework, it's just those four. But the other thing worth bearing in mind is that there's a light and a dark side to them. So the dark side is known as the shadow state. And so to explain that, one of the ways of thinking about it is that we're born into the world exactly as we should be. In some of the books that I've read, it's like, we're blazing clouds of glory and we're glowing with our own gold. And then as we slowly grow up, we realize there are some things that are unwelcomed by our parents. And as, we want to maximize the love that we get from our parents, we'll start putting things into our shadow bag. So an example of that is like, no, you shouldn't be angry about this, And for instance, if you're told that anger is completely, not correct, you'll shove all of your anger in into the shadow. And then as we start to socialize with friends at school, we realize that there are some things that are socially acceptable and some things that aren't, and to be included, we then put other parts of ourselves into the shadow. And by the time we're 20, from being this beautiful, glowing, golden person, we've probably got a little sliver that's left, and we've put the rest into the shadow. And these things, examples of this are like shame. So as a gay man, and many gay men, we have to deal with a lot of shame with our sexuality. That comes with the magician shadow, shame. With the warrior shadow, we've got, you should not exist as you are. That also is something that comes very much with kind of sexuality. But then if you're into fetish or you're a master or slave, that's other shame that you might have as well that kind of comes up. And then this idea of your gold and being who you are, that comes from the king. But if you've put a lot of what made you amazing into the shadow because you're ashamed or humiliated for it, then that's something else you need to kind of bring out as well. So there's a lot of different things that can come, that we kind of shove in there. And what the archetypes allow us to do is to essentially look at some of these aspects and how they can move into the shadow. And then I, in the book, then reinterpreted this for kind of masters and slaves. There is one other thing which is very specific to master slaves, I'd say, which is that as well as that, I think when we go into doing this power dynamics, we can actually have the call to what I call the dark side and to have a negative intent. And these can be very insidious, that rather than imagine you've got Jaws music playing and a big kind of danger sign above you, It can be very attractive to go to some of these dark places as well. And so, and what the book also covers is some of those insidious pulls that we all might have. And we might want to think we don't have them or we're not doing them, but we probably are.
Yeah.
It's human nature.
Well, yeah, what I was going to say, why do you think we have a pull towards that side?
Well, I think part of it's human nature. You know, if we use one of the examples, so a master as a magician is very good at transforming, you know, and so they can take a slave and figure out how to mold, how to change that slave to be the best they can be. So transforming, you're looking at that person, the mindset, and how you can change it. The shadow state is being a manipulator. Now, in some ways, there's very little difference between transformer and manipulator other than intent. But you can imagine starting to do something and not realizing that you're starting to be more of a manipulator rather than a transformer. And you suddenly end up over into the dark side. The other big thing is that we have very few good examples, either in the master-slave scene or in society in general. So the king is about being an amazing leader. There's very few people, be it in master-slave, be it in politics or government, or be it in companies, who are actually showing a good king state. Most of them are operating in a shadow state, such as one of them's the precocious prince, which is the immature person that thinks they can have everything. And then the idea of the tyrant, which is, you know, they're very insecure in their power, or someone that's very weak. And so there's very few kind of people that we can look to have good examples about how to be the best we can be as well.
Yeah, I think this is something we're going to touch on later on, but mentorship is a huge problem in our society. We have such a lack of direction and knowing how to work with ourselves. It's not there. It's not there at all. So do you think that this language is quite helpful for people to use in their dynamics with their partner or partners?
Yeah, I'd say the first thing is to use it for yourself, you know, so where are you, you know, and understand where your pause to the dark side is and where you might be struggling. You know, it's not unusual, especially for slaves, to have a lot of shame around their submission and sexuality. Masters often have a big shadow of insecurity in their power, you know, so using this to identify where you are is very useful. But then you can also use this framework to understand, you know, a potential partner, a potential master or slave, where are they? You know, and then if you're in a relationship, you can sort of have an open discussion about where you both might be having difficulties and where that might be impacting your master-slave relationship.
Yeah, yeah. And your book offers very practical, thought-out advice for each category and each subcategory of the archetypal framework. So it's very, very helpful. So let's go deeper into the book and let's talk about how each archetype can be represented. So can you say more about the king archetype?
So the king is, let's say, at the pinnacle of all of the archetypes. It's the one that all of the other archetypes should also serve. And the main thing about this is, what is your purpose? How are you going to be different? How will the world be different based on what you do in it? You know, so this is the impact that you're going to have. So an example of my king's purpose is to help people live their authentic life. And a big part of that is master-slave lifestyle and helping with that. It's also about having, you know, creating a good kingdom, affirming the people that are in it, but also around kind of having that strength of understanding your power and being able to use it well, according to the purpose as well.
Yeah. If I'm a slave, identify as submissive most of the time, how would I fit into the king archetype?
So I think what is good is for slaves to figure out what their own purpose is. But a big part of that purpose will be serving another master, you know, and helping their kingdom. But for instance, a lot of slaves can actually be pretty, you know, amazing leaders and have a lot of people they're in charge of. And so a lot of the king aspect with their role as a leader still applies to them. How are they a good leader to their teams? There's also a very important thing, like when I've met 24/7 slaves that are live-in partners without work, they can often struggle with a sense of self-worth because they don't have enough duties or they're not able to hone their skills and improve enough. So, you know, a master either needs to make sure that the slaves have enough work and doing enough that their self-worth can build up through duty to the master. Or, you know, the master needs to help that slave figure out, well, what is their other purpose and how they can do work for that to build up the self-worth as well. It's one of those interesting differences between the fantasy of a 24/7 living slave and the reality of it.
Yeah, which are very different things. What would shadow form of the king look like?
The shadow form of the king, you've got the idea of the tyrant and the weakling. You know, so the tyrant is someone who's incredibly insecure with their power. So they want to do everything to try and keep it or to destroy other people's. One of the examples I give, for instance, from a master slave point of view, was when I first started to try and go to the gym. And my master at the time was incredibly threatened by that and would always say, I don't know why you're bothering. You're never going to succeed. You're always going to be fat. And this was his way of trying to keep his power, you know, because me doing something like that, rather than celebrating or affirming it, he saw as a threat. Right. And the weakling is someone that really does not want to use their power. And from my personal experience now, I think a lot of masters actually have pulls or partly in some of these shadows. You know, that they're very insecure about their power, which is why, I mean, a lot of masters can project onto slaves, you're so weak, you're so worthless, why can't you do anything?
Yeah.
I had a slave that got in touch with me recently in Berlin, and they had to cancel. They'd just been signed off work with burnout. And I was just like, it's fine. I've burnt out myself. So I was just like, just remember how strong you are. I know that you feel that this is a failure right now. I mean, they met up for coffee, but they kind of said, I never thought I'd get a message like this from a master. Thank you so much. You know, whereas I think the contact that a lot of people normally have is just like, what, you can't meet up? What's wrong with you? Yeah. You know, my God, you're so weak. You're so pathetic. Just never contact me again. Yeah. But this is often the master's shadow of insecurity playing out and being projected onto the slave instead.
Yeah. So in season three of this, of the piece in Reimagined, Indy speaks about shame and defectiveness, and she comes to the realization that it was her shame and defectiveness of herself as a dominant, and she couldn't bear the feelings and bear the reality of that. So she definitely identified as then putting that onto the submissive and belittling them, degrading them.
Exactly. So
And
this is very common because our shadow can be hidden. That's why it's called the shadow. How we complain, how we talk about other people is often a sign of our shadow, you know. So, you know, and I've found a lot of masters will often use words like weak, insecure, even good ones, you know, that these sorts of things can kind of play out. And it's often their own in insecurities around their power playing through and being projected onto the people around them that tend to be slaves.
Yeah. And I can see how useful these archetypes are. When you said at the start, it's about intention, because if her, just taking Indy, for example, or just weakling, quote, weakling masters, if it's the deeper intention or the deeper instigator is fear or insecurity, then that makes a lot more sense. That's where it's coming from.
Exactly.
Yeah. Rather than the behavior itself.
Yes. You know, because you can humiliate someone consensually and they love it because it's empowering them as a slave, but you can also do it just to make yourself feel better.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes that can be consensual and good as well, but sometimes it might be that your shadow's playing and you want to do some work there.
Yeah. And then, yeah, knowing the deeper reason actually allows you to connect more. If both parties are conscientious and have open dialogue, you can talk more about, well, look, actually, I feel insecure and this is why I'm doing it. I want to still do it, but then I, as a sub, can connect with that more human part of them and be like, oh, okay, let's talk about that, or I can sit with that, I can hold that.
So because I have coached a master slave couple where that sort of insecurity turned into a real kind of serious issue, you know, and I actually did some shadow work with the master that allowed them to figure out why this was happening so they could start that healing process, because they didn't understand why their behavior was like that, and they realized it was bad, but they couldn't figure out where it was coming from and what to do. And so through my coaching, I was able to help them connect to what was going on so they could then start that process.
Yeah. Let's move into the warrior archetype. What characterizes a warrior archetype?
So it's the warrior is an interesting one, because we can have a view of this, which is quite toxic, you know, the toxic male masculinity that comes up. Whereas, let's say, the Jungian version of them, the warrior, is more, you know, someone of integrity, someone who wants to be a well-honed tool that trains to get to a really good point. You know, so we talk about someone of integrity, someone that takes action, and someone that is kind of really working to be the best that they can be. And of course, the warrior is also around protection or attacking, which is around boundaries as well.
And one thing that came up in your book around boundaries is if a sub or a master doesn't know their boundaries, that anger is a really good way to identify when a boundary, known or unknown, has been crossed. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's often key emotions for each of the archetypes, and for the warrior, it's anger. And so this can lead to some really interesting things, because if you're a slave and you want to be more submissive, sometimes your ego can get really angry because the master is stepping over your boundary. But part of this is consensual. It's like, yes, I need this to happen so I can move to my deeper level of submission. We can also have a master just overstepping the boundaries or ignoring limits or consent. And you then have anger coming up there. And then this is anger that you should be using to protect yourself. And you probably got an unhealthy master if they're doing that. So there's very much a tension here, you know, that if you are going into very deep kind of power dynamics, sometimes that anger is that your boundaries are being eroded, but in a way that you both want. But if you're dealing with more of a shadow master, perhaps your boundaries are being eroded in a way that's completely wrong and against anything that the scene should actually hold as part of itself.
Yeah. It's just a really refreshing reminder of how anger can be a very healthy, important part of the dynamic. If we're looking at warriors still, what would a shadow version look like?
So from the master side, you've got this idea of being a predator or a persecutor. So if anyone's done an intense scene and the top or the master's looking at you and they have an almost predatorial gleam in their eye, this is kind of like something that can be really erotic and amazing, and that's part of the master's warrior coming out. But that predatorial or persecution side can insidiously lead to something else, which is around basically trying to persecute someone. And so it's like, I want to get what I want from this slave, or I want this slave and I'm going to get them, and I'm going to do anything I can to do that, you know. And so this is when you're starting to ignore those limits and consents. The other thing is essentially dehumanizing the slave to the point that you can completely ignore their needs and not care about anything that happens to them. So as I said, I'm into dehumanization, but good dehumanization is the mutual fulfillment of each other's needs, not the complete obliteration or ignoring of them. And so there is a very interesting line there that everyone needs to be aware of. And from the slave side, it's almost like a counterpoint of that, about having no boundaries, destroying yourself in service to the master, you know. And so you can also see here that there can be an interesting loop. You have a master in the shadow and a slave in the shadow. They can reinforce each other. But normally what happens is both sides end up in a very unhealthy place.
Yeah.
The other thing that's worth bearing in mind is that one of the underlying kind of psychological shadows here is don't exist as you are. And so if you do have trouble with your identity as a slave or your identity as a master, this, you know, it's often you're going to have a bit of a muted warrior, yeah. You know, that's going to struggle to take action.
It's just not sustainable.
Exactly.
There is something very appealing around, I've been in this position before, wanting to be destroyed by a master, by something more powerful. You know, yes, take over me completely, destroy me, and I've actually also had subs who have wanted that. They wanted to, quote, not exist. And they love this idea. It's a very interesting psychological place to be in, especially if I see myself as more reflective and conscientious about what's going on here, really. So when someone presents themselves that to me, or if I am in that mood of, please take everything, use me completely, and don't think about me at all, I always just think, it's very arousing, but is it sustainable?
One of the things I talk about in the book, and I use this with a lot of coaching clients, is to discover your beast. Who is your beast? And because, you know, from a slave point of view, that beast can be, I just want to give everything up, you know. And from a master point of view, it's like, I want to destroy and literally have my gimp slave. Now, this is your beast talking. And so what a lot of people can do is really repress that down. It's like, that's dangerous. The better thing to do is literally to have a conversation with the beast to really understand what it wants. And quite often at first, some of the things that come out might be, well, this is just impossible to ever do. But then if you start to really figure out why is it saying that, what are the needs, you can actually create some really amazing and safe sessions and scenes that allow the beast to be fed. What's worth noting is the beast should never be in charge. Another part of yourself should be in charge, but you're literally creating this scene or ritual or session to feed the beast. And if the beast is fed, the beast is not going to come up unexpectedly and suddenly, you know, do something that you then regret.
Yeah.
So this is around listening to some of these parts of yourself rather than repressing them, and then creating things that allow it to be fed. And these things can then be very intense, but also very safe and time limited.
What would a session, I'm thinking for me, the session would have to be very symbolic. You know, if I brought out my beast and wanted my partner to destroy me, you know, to use that metaphor, I'm just thinking that it would be such a interesting conversation with my partner about how would that look like, and how would you speak to the beast whilst giving it, not giving it full control?
So, you know, one of the things when you really want to speak for the beast is have an immense, intense masturbatory session with yourself. And I'm talking, you know, light the candles or have a bath and spend a few hours with yourself. It's not a quick kind of come into a Kleenex tissue. You're basically going to go to town on yourself. And, you know, but have this as a sort of intent of, you know, I'm going to listen to the beast. And so you're really bringing out some of this darker side. But then afterwards, it's then trying to think, okay, what's really needed here? Then to actually really make something happen, I'd like to talk about, it's in a Raven Kerdera book that I read, and he speaks about this. And he talks about almost having like a session as a ritual. And part of it's just the warm up. A part of it at the end is just a good fucking, but the middle bit is all around the beast. And he actually does some very intense knife play with his sub. And so what he's doing is not really cutting or anything, but he's, you know, sort of moving the knife around the body. And then right at the apex, he creates a tiny cut, and licks some of the blood from it before putting the plaster on. Now, the way he writes about this, it's an incredibly intense scene, you know, like the slave's trembling, scared. This is all still consensual, you know, but there's a lot of energy and motion in there. But when you actually take a step back, it ends with a tiny little cut, which is also consensual. But the intensity and having that as in the apex allows the beast to be served. So sometimes it is creating these very charged sessions and scenes which are consensual, have a lot of emotion and power in, and can lead to something like in Raven Kadira's case, it was a little bit of blood and nicking that was the consumption, consuming the slave. Now, I'm not telling everyone to go out and do knife play. You know, there's many other ways that you can do it as well. It depends on what your kind of fetish is and how you manifest your power exchange. You know, but I like to give that one because it is just so intense. But when you actually look at it, actually not that much happened in it from a physical point of view.
Yeah. As you're speaking, I'm just thinking aftercare. Like, we're getting to a very primitive part of our psyche when we enter kink and BDSM, and you get into these very symbolic, metaphorical places. And when that is actualized, I imagine everything just comes rushing back, all the humanness, all the the day-to-day comes rushing back, and aftercare must be a very important part of this whole process.
So for most people, it probably is. I mean, it's always worth saying some people might not want aftercare. That is part of the scene. Yeah. You know, so I think it's having that discussion, what is needed, what is the consensual, and then checking in. Perhaps someone says, no, part of this scene, I really don't need the aftercare. And then they go, actually, I really did. So you learn for that next time. Yeah. So yes, aftercare is always important. And for the most part, it should be done. But also, it does depend on the individual people and what their needs are in that moment. You know, and so we shouldn't judge a slave that consensually says, I really don't want aftercare at this point. You know, from my point of view and others, that might be a strange one, but we should affirm their right to have what they need, even if it's different to us.
I think one thing which we're talking about is conversation and communication, and it just doesn't happen as much as I think it needs to. Like, people are not talking to each other about this stuff, especially on the online world, where it's just such a profile picture. There's an energy behind that picture, and people are talking to that energy straight away, and then they come, and that's it. They disconnect. And I just really think it's just not the way to go about these things. It does a huge disservice to this potential in us, which can reach these states.
Yeah, it's that kind of, you know, I think often with my conversations online, you're almost talking about the final state, you know, something that could only happen after many months of training. And so it's worth kind of going, what is going to happen first? You know, and what should always happen first for someone new is something far lighter and softer, with the expectations okay with that. You know, because some people can get disappointed that I didn't turn into a dehumanized slave. But no, that's not going to happen for quite a while, even if you moved in with a master. It takes time for that. Same with, let's say, you know, I want a really intense flogging. Everyone should be checking in with each other. Sometimes people say they want things, or they've lied about their experience. A good master or good top will always be checking in and going, okay, how deep can I go? What is the sort of journey I can go on? But also, everyone should be more open. You know, something that some really good masters have spoken to me about is that they talk about, I want to care for the slave and make sure they're okay. And then the slave goes, well, you're not the sort of master I want. I want someone that's going to use me ruthlessly and toss me aside. And that's more their dark shadow, because actually most people who have gone through that would never want that again, you know, but they're literally kind of looking for the shadow master. And then masters who are not in the shadow are feeling very dismissed and marginalized. But you can also have people shaming fetishes and needs in the discussion. So then we start to close down and not talk about them as well. So, you know, someone might have a fetish or need, which you go, yeah, that is not my thing, or I don't feel comfortable with that. And you can say that without shaming the other person. But again, sometimes it makes us feel insecure that we don't want to do something with someone else. So then we project onto them, well, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Because we feel there's something wrong with us. But it's just like, no, we all have different needs. From the warrior, we have different boundaries. So let's have those boundaries while still affirming the right of the other person to have their experience, even if you're not the best person to serve that.
Yeah. Let's move into the magician archetype. I think this one really resonates to me. I like the magician archetype. Can you say more about this one?
Yeah, this is my favorite because I have such a strong magician myself. So the magician is around the transforming part if you're the master. So it's about, you are taking a slave, and how do you move them to another state, move them deeper into submission, kind of unblock them so they can go deeper, or just bring out their submissive side. It's the problem solver, let's say, of the archetypes. You have your purpose, you have your mission. How do you do it? The magician is going to tell you how. The other interesting thing is there's a more magical side to it. I call it the intuitive side in the book, but it's quite often when you're doing power play, there's something more that's there. And really skilled masters can actually into that and listen to it. So for instance, I was mastering a slave at one point, and I suddenly had this message, the slave's done now. There's nothing in the body language to say that.
Yeah.
But I then kind of checked in, and the slave was like, I think I'm done, so I'm empty. You know, and because I could have pushed forward, you know, but I had that message. Sometimes you can have the message go for it. Go forward. They need this right now. And this intuitive side, it's not your ego talking. It's something else. And so this is the more magical place where more amazing things can happen as well. From the slave side, it's that openness to being trained, that openness for growth as well, you know. But from the slave side as well, there's also very other interesting aspect, which is the safety officer. And so if you've had some horrific things happen in your past, this could be in childhood, or it could be with another master, you tend to have a very strong safety officer. I have a friend that calls his the wolf, you know, and it was very strange. Mine activated yesterday. I was seeing a master for a flogging session, and I said, oh, I want to have a conversation about this. And suddenly I was like, oh, this sounds really serious. And I just got in touch to say, is this a fun thing or is this a serious thing? It's like, no, it's a fun thing. Why are you asking? And I was like, my protection, my safety officer just activated. And mine is very strong because of some horrific things that have happened with a couple of masters in the past. And so I need to be very aware that I have this very strong protection part of myself, which sometimes is not helpful and sometimes is very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, I can definitely see magician archetype coming through you. It's something which is very clear for me. How would the shadow magician look like?
So from the master side, that transforming turns into manipulation. And you also have this other idea of the persecutor as well. What's interesting here is essentially, you know, if you stop connecting with the slave again, so there's that idea of a lack of connection or empathy or compassion, and you just start to treat the slave like an object, you can do anything you want to them and not really care. If you're going into deeper power exchange, there are consequences. And what happens is some masters just don't care about them. It's like, oh, I managed to really open up the slave and they're now in this state. It's taken me 2 years. Great. Well, I figured that out. Go away, slave. I'm bored of you now. I want to do something different. And that is the shadow magician. It's just like, I had fun playing with my toy, and now I want to go on to something else, and I don't need to care about the consequences of it. Whereas, of course, the slave is left in an awful state, picking up on the pieces. I was speaking to someone recently, and they'd had 2 years of, you know, very intense power control in a power exchange relationship, and then the master was like, I'm going to have a vanilla relationship now. Fuck off, you know, and they're having to, you know, really heal themselves. You know, and it's not the slave's fault, you know, the master was basically a shadow magician and wanted to have fun but not really care that deeper power exchange has consequences, and a good master should take responsibility for it.
Part of the uniqueness of your book is that you bring in a lot of personal experiences, and there is a moment in the book where you talk about your own experience with being in touch with a shadow magician or a person who manipulated you after a few years. Do you want to say a bit more about that?
Yeah, so this was someone that I trusted implicitly. You know, at this point, I had a very binary, I either trust or I don't, rather than, let's say, a staircase of trust. And I chose completely the wrong person. And they were essentially going to be a mentor master and allow my slave side to come out. And I ended up being manipulated horrifically to the point that my slave self, let's say, had a breakdown. I then had to spend 2 years trying to heal that part of me. You know, it's really strange when you talk about power exchange and 24/7, you have this idea of breaking the human side so the slave can come out. You don't expect the slave side to get broken. But the truth of the matter was that I was, let's say, a piece of meat or a sweet to keep another slave in the stable. And as soon as we grew too close, I was then a risk to the slave leaving the stable. But that wasn't what I was told. There was an entire kind of cobwebs of subterfuge and other things, which I believed all of it, which is why I got so fucked up on the situation, you know. And many slaves that are on the more serious side, so 24/7, you know, total power exchange, will come across at least one of these people, you know. And after we've had it the first time, we learn to protect ourselves. And my hope is, by other people knowing this, that you can actually avoid it the first time, you know. At its very simplest, this is the typical psychopath that we're talking about, who manipulates someone without really caring. you know, but I still carry some of the scar tissue now with what happened with that person. But I managed to turn a lot of that poison into gold through master slave lifestyle.
I think it's a real comment on how deep these wounds can strike, you know, how deep this stuff happens. We're playing at a very primitive level here. And these breaches in trust and respect and consent can really take a long time to process and resolve.
Very much. You know, I always recommend therapy if you need it, especially, you know, at the very least a kink, a rare therapist, but someone who knows a bit more. You know, the trouble is that although a lot of therapists can be aware of kink, they can struggle a bit with master slave, you know, and they can have more issues with that. And often you need to do much more education. I know with some of the therapists I've had at certain points, they wanted to attach onto something, go off, let's talk about that. And like, no, that's really not the issue. I want to talk about this. This is the issue.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, and then also coaching and stuff can help, such as myself, you know, because I can come from a more knowledgeable point of view, but I can't help with trauma because I'm not a therapist.
Yeah. I just think I'm kind of piecing back all these little exchanges that I had with subs and doms in the past. And now I can apply some of these terms on what was actually happening. There was one sub who wanted me to pretend to be his best friend. And they would worship me as a result. And it was manipulation. They wanted me to manipulate them. Say, oh, no, you're my best friend. Of course I'd never lie to you. Of course I would never. So I'm just finding the use of this framework to really kind of apply for everything.
You know, and it's worth saying that sometimes you can have a scene to cleanse some of the trauma if it's consensual on both sides. So perhaps he was trying to do some cleansing and processing there. But, definitely, you know, the other person needs to be happy and okay with that as well.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it might be you're just trying to replay through trauma without processing it, and then that's probably not as good.
Yeah. Before we move on to the lover, you said there is a kind of primary emotion. So anger was for the warrior. What's an emotion state that lives with the magician?
It's fear.
Fear.
So quite often, if you want to attach into your magician, it's more about fear, you know. So this can be fear of the unknown, like I don't know how to solve a problem, or there's this deep energy in this thing called master slavery. How do I do it? And this is also where the safety officer comes from as well. But the other reason why this exists is one of the other big emotions is shame. That kind of comes out in the magician side as well, shame of who you are. So, you know, it's a generalization, but a reasonably accurate one. But most gay people will have shadow of the magician because of the shame we have from our sexuality or from our fetishes. It's really interesting. Like when you start writing a book like this, you start to examine yourself again, despite all of the therapy you had. And I was really surprised that this year I actually found some new shame about wanting to be a beast for someone. And it was really strange. I thought I'd done all my work on shame. And then here was a bit more that came up again. And, you know, something about I'm normally proudly talking about on the website. And so if people are listening going, well, I don't have any shame left now, just be aware that it is a journey. And you've probably done a lot of amazing work to get rid of the shame you've had, but there is probably more work that will come at some point in the future. And then slaves in particular can have real struggle around shame of their slavery because society doesn't really celebrate or like people that want to give their power up to someone else and serve them. And so there's often a lot of work we need to do to embrace the fact we are slaves and that this is a beautifully good, amazing thing, rather than something to feel shamed about.
Yeah, I really feel like that's a huge process for many, many people. It's very, very difficult. So to move on, I'm interested to know then about the lover archetype and what exemplifies, what represents the lover.
The lover is about connection. And so for anyone that's made the connection already, it's interesting. We talk about some of the shadow states. It's about no connection. So having a strong lover allows you to counter some of the shadow that can happen within the warrior and the magician. You know, this is around empathy, connection. It's also about being vulnerable. So this is true for both masters and slaves. You know, a lot of masters do not want to be vulnerable. They don't want to open themselves up. Yes, I've made a mistake, or yes, I love you. In the book, I do talk about how, you know, as a gay man, you know, the fetish scene, sometimes, you know, that idea or leather or rubber, it's actually trying to put a barrier from connecting. Some, you know, other times it's not, but it can be this barrier that I'm the alpha leather man and I don't need to connect. I'm just in charge kind of thing. And I'm going to fuck you, but then you go away and leave me alone. Now that can be a fetish and it can be a turn on. It's good. But also for some people, it can be a way of not connecting.
Yeah.
You know, for slaves, I kind of talk about submission or obedience. You know, obedience is just obeying the person without really ever opening up. And some slaves can hide through obedience without ever really connecting. Whereas true submission is you really open up. You really open up yourself, your heart center, who you really are, to go into those deeper levels of submission as well. And so, you know, you've got both masters and slaves needing to figure out how they can actually open up and truly be themselves rather than a facade.
Yeah, it's very easy to hide behind, you know, props is not the probably too crude a word, but to hide behind uniforms and costumes as well. Yeah, really is.
The other thing is having too much connection, wanting to connect too much. And this kind of links into the nihilism we've spoken about before. But I think especially within the gay community, this is also why crystal meth and other drugs and addiction can be such an issue. It's also going after the everlasting orgasm, you know, and drugs help us to do that until we realize the cost of it, you know, and especially with drugs, you're not actually connecting to a person, you're connecting to the drug. Mm. And so as a scene in general, I think we do have an issue with, you know, not having connection, and often we're not having connection because of the drugs we're using to connect too much.
Yeah. Is this more on the shadow side of the lover then, where this is some of the behavior that exemplifies that? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just to clarify, connection is with the lover. Fear is centered around the magician. And then we have anger around the warrior. We didn't say what the king was.
The lover first.
Oh.
That emotion is grief, which sounds very strange. You know, it's non-intuitive in a way. But quite often, if we don't allow ourselves to grieve for loss or for things we haven't had, then we can't connect, you know. So, you know, I will often have a lot of grief around, you know, never finding the right master. And as I'm in this transition stage, I am processing a lot of grief around my slave self as well. And that grief is the thing that I never had, that I wish to have had. As well as, you know, having two masters that I loved, you know, ghost me, which is an actual grief and loss, you know. So quite often we need to kind of connect in with our grief in order to really access the lover and to be able to connect well. And especially in Western society, we're not really taught how to grieve. It's seen as an emotion we should repress.
Yeah. And then the king emotion?
The king is joy.
Joy.
Because the king's so related to purpose, it's what gives you joy, you know. And so quite often, you know, when I'm coaching people around their passion or purpose in my career coaching, very much I'm using things around the emotion of joy, or some people don't like that. So you also can think of it as like a flow state, you know. But when you're really activating your king because you're living your purpose, then the emotion is often joy.
Yeah. Where did these emotional states come from, these words? Is this something that you've thought through, or was it something that you've researched?
This comes from, you know, proper psychological Jungian researchers. So I'm just kind of taking what they have researched, you know, and saying it again. So I cannot take credit for that. Other much better people than me have kind of done the work there.
Yeah. There's some things that pop out in the book, one of which is, it's a very common idea, and that's that the slave has more strength, more power than the dom. Is that a way of saying it, or has it been too gentrified?
Yeah, so I think there's this strange thing that, you know, the master's in charge, so he must have all of the strength. Whereas very often, I think it's the slave who's the stronger one. One that they've had to deal with a lot of shame and a lot of society's kind of pressures that you should not be this to get to the point, yes, I am a slave and I want to serve. And there's a lot of power in giving yourself up to someone, you know. So in some ways, it's very easy to label yourself as a master and do things. Whereas that when you truly embrace yourself as a slave, you know, you've had to do a lot more work. I mean, one of my podcast episodes, I was speaking to Master Richard, who heads up the Tashra Institute, who was talking about some preliminary research around fetish identity. And this was something they actually discovered, that slaves often hold their identity as a slave very central to their personality, whereas masters don't tend to do that. And their assumption, they need to do more kind of work on this, is because there has to be so much work you have to do to embrace your identity as a slave, and therefore becomes much more central to your identity. You have to work harder at it. And then, of course, depending on how you're training a slave, you know, the slave is literally becoming a warrior. They're, you know, let's say you're doing certain positions, or you're training someone to be better at taking flogging or pain. There's a lot of work and effort that's going into becoming a better slave.
Yeah. You describe, as I said before, a few incidents that happened to you in your experience, in your journey of BDSM. And there was a moment that you said where you had to learn what you actually liked as a sub and the fetishes you enjoyed, rather than what you think you enjoyed or what you think was the right thing to do for the master. Can you say a bit more about that?
So, you know, what can happen at times is, as a slave, if you're really focused on the master's needs, you can forget your own. And that is what I had done, you know. And so when I'd broken up with the master I'd moved to Berlin for, I think it was about a year later, I was taking part in a workshop where, you know, it wasn't fetish, but, you know, you could ask to touch someone or to have a hug or something like that. You know, and there's all this warm up, and then it was like, okay, go around and ask for someone for what you need. And all I could do was stand there, because I'm like, I have no idea what I need. And that was a real light bulb moment, like, oh God. And then, of course, I'm thinking, well, you know, it's probably because this isn't fetish. It's like, so what as a slave do I need? And I couldn't tell you. And so I had to really start to think again, what is it I actually need again? Yeah. But this is also true for people who are just starting out. It's like we have all these fantasies and desires, but do we actually know what we need, or do we think we know what we need? And the only way that you can kind of move into really knowing is to have experiences and experiments, but then really reflecting and starting to build up your own identity. Okay, I really love bondage. Oh, I really hate pain. And then maybe 10 years later, oh, actually, I think I quite enjoy pain now. You know, so you're constantly kind of looking at yourself and understanding, what are my needs? From a power exchange point of view, what do I need to feel like a slave? What do I really dislike? What things surprise me? You know, and so you're slowly building up a picture, because it's normal to not know a lot of this stuff straight away. And so we need to go on a journey to start figuring it out, but that journey never really stops.
Yeah. Because I just know that many newcomers would be like, I just want to serve my master and make him happy. But I don't think that there's truth in that, definitely. But there are things that you will not like and things that you will definitely like. And it's good to bring that to the surface and make it known and explore it and see what happens. Because I, for one, do not like pain at all. I'm open to it with the right person, but pain is a very uncomfortable place for me.
It also, let's say, depends on the sort of pain. You know, I did this master last night at a flogging workshop, and then he was just checking, so do you actually like flogging? And I was like, yes, but I'm more essentialist, so I like it as a journey of pain. Whereas there is another master that I served who is an incredibly skilled and good master, but he likes to just have right at it. He likes more masochists, and I'm certainly not a masochist. You know, so sometimes it's also the connection and the quality and how it's manifested can be very different, and you need to figure out what flavors you like. I was kind of saying that you can imagine that you're sort of, you know, a wine expert, and you know, but if you're just starting out, you're sort of starting to learn all the different sorts of wines and the flavors, and then you start to discover what your preferences are. It's not just, do I like red or white, but what regions do I like? What do I like pairings? You know, there's all sorts of things that you can kind of suddenly go deeper in as you get more experienced. And that allows you to understand yourself better.
At the end of the book, there's a really nice twist, and it's a chapter called Heart-Centered Master and Heart-Centered Slave. Can you talk more about this principle or concept and why you included it in the book?
Yes. So, you know, through most of the book, I've separated it into these different components so you can understand it at a smaller level. But I think we as masters and slaves should actually have our own archetype. You know, and I decided it was about the heart-centered master and the heart-centered slave, people that are truly opening up to themselves and to others, that are truly on a journey of growth. None of us, you know, archetypes are archetypes because we can't really reach them. We only see them in fiction and stuff because they're not true characters. So they're also North Stars of where we can head to. And I think, you know, creating an archetype of the heart-centered master or the heart-centered slave, this is the North Star that we can all head to. This is what I am aiming for. In some of the books I've read, for instance, you know, the only, you know, you've got to get into your 50s before you can actually become a good king, because it takes that amount of time to do a lot of work on your shadow to start manifesting it if you're doing the work. You know, there's not many people that do. And so this is sort of a flag, a star to say, why don't we all start heading towards this? And then we can create a scene and a community that is based on the light rather than the shadow.
Very lovely place to end it there. I think it's a beautiful statement. I did really love this book. I want to know more and learn more. I think part of its success is its very practical steps. It's not just abstract ideas. It's, this is what you can do. This is how you can have the conversation. This is what to look out for. So it's very relatable. It's not an incredibly dense, thick book that you have to spend months and months. It's almost like a guide that you can pick up and think, okay, I'm sensing this kind of reaction in me. What can I do to work with this? And it's something that if I get a partner, I would love to read with and through. And what a great center of conversation to learn about each other and then how to take our BDSM and kink deeper. Another really good part of this book is the signposting you do. There's a lot of links to different websites, places, ideas, groups. And I just think that that's a reflection of a person who's really interested in other people's well-being and other people's success in their own journey. It's a very, very good idea that you did that.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I really appreciate hearing that.
Yeah, well done. If listeners want to know more about you or to find you, can you let them know your handles?
Yes. So if you're interested in the book, go to masterslavelifestyle.com/book. And for anyone that's listened to this podcast, I'm also happy to offer free coaching for you. And you can do that by reaching out to contact@masterslavelifestyle.com. And then if you just want to find more about me, go to masterslavelifestyle.com and you'll find everything else there.
Well done. And I really mean this. Thank you for your contribution to the community. It's invaluable.
Thank you so much.